The hour of 10:15 having arrived, I will call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. Members, today, what we're looking at here is we're going to finish up House File 1589 and House File 1590 in that order. Then we're going to House File 1176, and then we'll go down from there. We have a very full agenda today, but yet I expect a full and robust debate on these issues. So, when we have a quorum, I'll move House File 1589. This would be the Davids bill, and I believe it's the department's something bill. Mr. Cummings?
Quality bill. High performance. Policy and technical.
Okay, yeah. I mean, all my bills are high quality.
That's so right. That's right.
Of course. For sure. Okay. So with that, was there anyone from the audience who wished to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Okay, we got a couple concerns. Could you kind of, when we have a quorum, I'll be moving the bill so it's actually before us, but could you, you have a few comments to wrap up. And members, 1589 and 1590 are bills that we heard, I think it was last week. And so we're bringing them. We had some folks who wanted to testify with concerns, I believe, on it. So, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, I am here as a resource. I just wanted to make sure that if the committee had any questions related to the policy and technical bills or related to the testimony that we're here for you in the committee, Mr. Chair.
Can I buy one of those oil things?
Mr. Chair, I think we can. I think we can. Work something out.
Is it worth less than $5?
They are definitely, well, it depends on where you go, Mr. Chair, but this one would be less than $5.
I'd say it's priceless. Okay, who would like to come down and testify? I don't think there's anybody else that wants to testify on behalf of, is there? Okay, we've got a few folks, I believe, that have some concerns. Maybe, Mr. Cummings, you can just stay right there. And let's see, we've got Ms. Cadoon and then Mr. Inus. If you could join us down here, Mr. Inus, too, get a chair if you would. Maybe a page could get a chair there. Okay, he's good there. Okay. Okay, why don't you start out? Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chamber, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I just want to flag an issue that in the policy bill, which I believe is Senate file, or not Senate file, 1589, the House file?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. It's the policy section. It's the miscellaneous article, which I believe is Article 4. There's some notice changes that are being done, and these notice changes are when the clock really starts ticking for taxpayers on their ability and their ability to do appeals. They're changing those notice requirements to do deleting when the mailing date and adding the notice date as determined by the commissioner. Our concern on that is those are really important dates because those determine when you're going to have your appeal abilities, and we want to make sure that taxpayers are notified. What this language would do, and we've flagged this for the department, and I believe Mr. Cummings mentioned we had forwarded some language, and so we hope we can have some basically comfort language put in to make sure that the notice date that the commissioner does is after when the taxpayers are actually notified by a mail. And we think that's important comfort language to have, and hopefully we can work on that and get something that's acceptable and make sure that taxpayers have adequate notice.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Maybe you could have your people talk to their people and see if we can come up with something here.
Mr. Chair, we have forwarded some language. I haven't heard back from the department as of yet.
Okay, so we'll give them some time to take a look at it. Questions for members on this issue? Okay, any response from the department?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Cadoon has forwarded language to us, and we are reviewing it. The language, I think we'll just have to work on making sure that it works, but we understand the Chamber's concern, and we look forward to working with the Chamber to come up with the solution that works.
Now, they're good to work with. They're good folks. Okay. Okay, no questions for members. Let's go to any questions for Ms. Cadoon here on this? Let's go to the next testifier. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, I just found a dime in this chair. Now, is that your dime, or does it belong to me?
Yes, I was missing it. It's part of the David's dollars. It just show up everywhere.
Can you give me the date on it?
Not yet. Okay, welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines. I'm here on behalf of the Travel Tech Association.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
The Travel Tech Association is a trade association that represents online travel companies such as Expedia, Travelocity, Orbitz, Priceline, etc. And my comments are directed at the technical bill. I believe it's House File 1590. And I want to hear to voice our strong opposition to Article 2.
Okay, Mr. Ines, what if we hold right there? I'm looking for more testimony, 1589. Okay, when we have a quorum, I'll move this for possible inclusion. I believe we already amended this, 1589. Ms. Dalton? We already did? Okay. We'll bring that before. So let's get the bill that Mr. Ines is interested in. House File 1590, members. When we have a quorum, I will move 1590. And I think we did that amendment, too. Yeah. Okay, so we've got 1590 before us. Could you state your concerns, please, Mr. Ines, on that one?
Yeah, Chairman, members of the committee, once again, I want to voice our strong opposition to Article 2, Section 2 as amended, I believe. This provision would impose more than 120 local lodging taxes on accommodation intermediaries. And to be clear, accommodation intermediaries includes more than just online travel companies like Expedia and Orbitz. It would include a broad universe of hospitality industry-related businesses. The Department of Revenue has actually defined accommodation intermediaries in a very broad fashion, and I'll read it directly from their own revenue notice. They define accommodation intermediaries as to include vacation rental home operators, travel consolidators, tour operators, and any other person that facilitates the sale of lodging, as well as charges a room charge to the customer. So that universe of taxpayers could include, depending on the business model, travel agencies. It could include a wedding planner that books rooms on behalf of their clients. It obviously includes online travel companies. It could include tour operators. So it's a broad universe of folks that would be impacted by the imposition of these local lodging taxes. The administrative and tax compliance costs associated with complying with 125 separate jurisdictions would be significant. And I want to respectfully take issue with how the department has framed this issue. They've included in the department technical bill. It's clearly a tax increase. It's clearly would impose more than 120 local lodging taxes on this subset of taxpayers. And they have framed it in a way that says, well, this is just a clarification. This is just a representation of legislative intent, which is not a factually accurate statement. Over the last 7 or 8 years, there have been numerous bills introduced that would do exactly what this section attempts to do. Those bills have been thoroughly vetted and debated by this legislature. They have all been rejected by the legislature. And I think it's worth noting that they've been rejected by a Republican-controlled legislature. They've been rejected by a Democratic-controlled legislature. And I'm hopeful that this legislature will also reject the imposition of these lodging taxes. Chairman, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you for that. I'll officially call the House Tax Committee to order. Members, we're going to revert back to House File 1589 as amended. This is the one that we have just done. So I'll move that House File 1589 as amended be laid on the table for possible inclusion. Or we could send this one out. Of course, we'd give due notice or anything. This could be sent out separately, possibly. Okay, so with that, now I will move House File 15. Well, first of all, we've got to take care of some important business here. Representative Simonson moves the minutes. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion prevails.
I was kind of
concerned that if, I don't know what we're going to do if Simonson has to miss the meeting.
Right.
That would, we would just have to figure something out. Okay, so with that, House File 1590 is amended. Mr. Ines, you were talking about Article 2. If you have the bill, members, that'd be page starting on 14. Oh, it's the amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Lanchesky.
Mr. Chair, maybe I misheard you. I thought you just said 1590 as amended. Is there an amendment?
We did that last week. That was amended last week.
Oh. So this isn't a new amendment to this bill today?
No.
Thank you.
No. Thank you. We include it so members can try to remember what we did.
Mr. Chairman, it's like a Mall of America TIF LGA thing, right? That's
it's in the technical and policy. No problem. Okay, so with that, sorry to cut you off there, Mr. Ryan, so if you could please continue. You're on page, basically on the amendment.
Yeah, the amendment, I believe it's Article 2, Section 2 as amended. And just once again, this provision would impose more than 120 separate and distinct local lodging taxes on this universe of the hospitality industry. And as I said before, I don't think this is reflective of legislative intent whatsoever. Over the last 8 or 9 years, the legislature has debated numerous proposals that would do exactly what is in front of you. Those proposals have been thoroughly vetted, debated, and rejected. This is not a new issue. I think the legislature has spoken loud and clear on this issue, and the legislative intent clearly indicates that they have not been interested in imposing these additional taxes on the hospitality industry.
Thank you, Ms. Trinas. Representative Lincheski.
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, I care a lot about this issue. In fact, this is the bill I was talking about that I was trying to get a hearing for. And it's not identical to this. What the former commissioner is testifying about is, in fact, what I believe you put into law in 2011. And, you know, I think there's a number of things going on in this provision as it relates to the OTCs. And so, you know, we didn't have enough time, quite frankly, to have a hearing in property taxes. It was taken up after the time we were supposed to adjourn, and I think the hearing lasted about a minute and a half. Yeah. And there were a lot of people waiting to testify, and I quickly said a couple things, and Mr. Reiners quickly said a couple things, and we had adjourned. So, you know, I hope we'll have a longer discussion about that piece of legislation. But so for the OTCs, you know, I think they're here on this department bill as it relates to what you passed in 2011. And, you know, you, I guess, know what your own legislative intent was. But there is an issue as it relates to what is the basis for taxation for lodging. So, as you know, Mr. Chair, in the lodging tax, we require that a certain piece of that tax that's the hospitality industry pays, and you know, as I've stated before, you know, I have the largest hospitality industry in the state of my district. Bloomington has more hotels than Minneapolis and St. Paul combined, and so we're very aware of how the lodging tax works. And for members who may have forgotten, a chunk of it has to get carved off to the visitors and convention bureaus around the state. And I think, you know, Mr. Innes is referencing those 125 communities that also levy the lodging tax. Yet in the 2011 tax bill, there was a change in law to require that cities that have the state as the tax collector, those OTCs would pay the tax. So it's kind of a bricks and mortar issue versus online services. So your legislation put that into law and said if the state's the tax collector for the lodging tax, you know, you're gonna pay this tax. And I guess what Mr. Innes is saying is, you know, but there wasn't an intent that the local piece would fall down to the locals in the case of your legislation, Minneapolis and St. Paul and some others. We have in state law, and it was known at the time of that conference committee, which I was a part of, we have in state law that all local taxes levied must be the same as the state base. And Ms. Dalton can read us the statute that says that. So the idea that the folks in 2011 didn't know what they were doing when they imposed the change in the lodging tax, thereby, you know, part of the money going to the Convention and Visitors Bureau, part going locally and part going to the state, you know, I don't really follow that, but that really is irrelevant in the sense, Mr. Chair, that our state law requires that.
Yeah.
And unless we're going to turn over state sales tax law, you know, I hope we'll think long and hard about this piece. So, you know, Mr. Chair, you know, maybe if it would be okay, we could ask Ms. Dalton to read the statute to people who to know what I'm, you know, really referencing here. So that I never thought it was in question how it trickled down to the locals when you passed it, because it's not permitted to do anything else. So, if, you know, maybe Ms. Dalton can just help the committee understand that.
Dalton,
piece.
You have that. Why don't you look at that? Any, Mr. Innes?
Chairman, Representative Chesky, thanks for the question. I guess the question. You know, in 2011, when you're accurate, in 2011, the legislature did impose the general sales tax. They amended 297A, which is the general sales tax statute. They did not amend 469, which is the local lodging taxes. That was a conscious decision on their part. If they wanted to roll in the local lodging taxes, they certainly knew how to amend the statutes to do that. They chose to exclusively amend 297A, which was the general sales tax law. I think the department's interpretation after the law passed is what really folded those four taxes into the equation. And I think a lot of us who followed this issue were not aware at the time that statute was going to implicate those four lodging taxes in that way. Also, it's worth remembering that 2011 was fairly unique legislative year. It was the year of the shutdown. There wasn't the kind of conference committee that I think we're traditionally used to having. My understanding was I don't think the provision in 297A that amended it was in either tax bill, but it ended up being in the final conference committee report. I believe that is the case. Never happened before, I know. But I do think that if the legislature truly wanted to roll in the local lodging taxes, all they had to do was amend Chapter 469. They opted not to do that. To me, that's a clear intention on the part of the legislature.
Chair Lanchesky.
Well, Mr. Chair, I hope we'll talk more about this. And, you know, I just think folks should think a little bit about, you know, the testimony, with all due respect, that, you know, the legislature's debated this forever and never done it. You know, we've had mixed, you know, we've had legislatures passing things and governors vetoing them, and there has been talk about this. It's actually fairly new. I think Representative Lesch carried the first bill that I can remember as it relates to this, and so for members who maybe aren't following it, but people should be, because most of you are affected by it. You know, the way it works is if you have a hotel in your district, which most people in this room do, they pay a tax when a room is reserved. And when you, if you instead get that room through Expedia, Orbitz, or somebody else, they get to avoid the tax. So if you have the St. Cloud, let's say, Visitors Bureau, you know, they're not getting as much as they should get because some folks aren't paying the tax. And, you know, the consumer isn't aware of this, but it is a fairness issue. And you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul are doing this. And, you know, their hotels aren't going out of business or anything. So, you know, I think what the rub is, Mr. Chair, is if you happen to have the state collecting the tax for you. So for a bunch of our cities, the state collects the lodging tax, and for a bunch it doesn't. We collect them local. Either way, someone has to be the tax collector. The local entities who do it themselves don't get these receipts, and the folks who have the state collecting it do. And it's just an inherent unfairness. I mean, one thing you could do is have it taken away from the other ones, to be fair. But to have some cities receiving this and not others, you know, I think is questionable. And Mr. Chair, if I may, I just want to ask Mr. Innes. I have heard via the grapevine, we have never met on this, so I just want to ask, you know, the law passed in 2011. Can you just, you know, and maybe this is completely not true, but I heard that the OTCs are refusing to remit the tax to Minneapolis, even though it's the law. And are you in litigation with Minneapolis, or, you know, if the law passed in 2011, it's 2015. Are the OTCs remitting the tax due by state law to Minneapolis?
Mr. Innes?
Chairman, Representative Lanchesky, I'm not aware of any litigation. The OTCs are clearly aware of what Department of Revenue's interpretation is, how the law should be applied. I do not have any personal knowledge about whether they are actually remitting the tax.
Okay.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, sorry to take a lot of time on this, but this was the day that you said we would discuss any changes to this bill.
Right. And this is the bill that is supposed to have no discussion because it's so non-controversial, put
right.
you to sleep. So, obviously, right. we have some folks that have a concern here, and we may, department's response?
Well, I just wanted to say two things, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the policy and technical bill is not intended always to be non-controversial. We are trying to point out problems within the tax code, things that are intended to make the tax code more clear and transparent and applicable when needed. So, you know, I don't want to leave the impression that solving problems within the tax code is always non-controversial. We try and, you know, make it so it's like watching paint dry, and I think we were partially successful. But, Mr. Chair, this proposal is in our technical bill because you know, as stated in the effective date language, it confirms that local lodging taxes, whether authorized under 469 or by special law, were intended to apply to the entire consideration paid to obtain lodging, such as services provided by the accommodation intermediaries as defined in 297A and similar services. It's consistent with the department's current interpretation, as a former Commissioner Ines said, of existing law for lodging taxes administered by the department. So, finally, Mr. Chair, is there a rule against former commissioners testifying against department technical
Mr. Cummings, I actually find it quite fascinating. And I don't. Since we don't have any rules, I guess it can't be against the rules.
All right, Mr. Chair.
We'll spend a bit more time on this, and then we're going to move on with things. Chair Erickson, and then Representative Swaldinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question for revenue. Do the hotels, then, that are located on reservations remit this tax when they remit various taxes to the Department of Revenue to receive their refund? Are they included in this? Because my largest hotel is on trust land.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I'm gonna phone a friend here.
I'd be in trouble if I had a phone a friend. Please state your name and who represents off the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I handle tribal issues for the department.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson. We have tax agreements with the tribes that cover the state sales taxes. Those agreements generally don't cover local taxes. So I don't know for sure the answer to your question, but they're not covered by the agreement, so they're probably not being paid.
Chair Erickson?
That's all I needed to know.
Chair Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think Ms. Dalton can weigh in on that, too. I mean, I think the answer is if the state is the tax collector, the tax is being paid. And if any legislators don't know if the state is the tax collector at your hotel or if you are the tax collector, you should go find out. I mean, that's the fundamental difference. Representative Simonson, I believe, you know, the state is the tax collector there, so they're receiving the tax. Bloomington, the state isn't, so we're not getting the tax. You know, so I mean, it's just an incredible unfairness. But you know, Mr. Chair, I hear you loud and clear. This is, you know, you and I both have had past practice that if anything's controversy, it generally comes out. So I think this is coming out. I mean, I get that, but that doesn't mean that the issue, you know, what the problem for the department is, then the issue remains unresolved if people are suing and not paying the tax. And so, you know, maybe offline someone could let me know definitively if the OTCs are paying the tax in Minneapolis that they are required to do it due to 2011 law, because I have heard repeatedly they are not, and that should be a huge concern. I mean, generally when you sue people, you still have to pay the tax. And then you can go sue, and then you can recover, or you can hope the legislature changes the law, but the law is the law. And so, Mr. Chair, the only thing I want to ask is for Ms. Dalton to remind members that when you change a sales tax on anything, auto parts, you know, you name it, you have to follow the base of the state sales tax, and if she can read that part of the law to us, I think it refutes a lot of the testimony that we've heard. And it doesn't matter where the legislation is brought in into what part of the statute it's brought into. The law still applies. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lincheski. And what I'm looking at here, members, is I respectfully disagree with Mr. Cummings in that technical bills to me are technical, and they shouldn't have a whole lot of controversy. So if we would, as a committee, decide to strip that part out, that doesn't mean we don't continue the dialogue on that part. Now, I think there's some bills out there that can do it, or we can have an amendment somewhere to bring the issue back. But I think in the meantime, the department and interested parties should visit. So let's go to Ms. Dalton, and I think we'll go on to the next item here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, under Section 270C.171, which deals with special laws and local taxes, it states that if the Department of Revenue either has agreed to or is required to administer the tax, such that the tax is reported and paid with the Chapter 297A taxes, then the local government unit or group of units must adopt each definition used in the special law as follows. The definition must be identical to the definition found in Chapter 297A or in Minnesota Rules Chapter 8130, or if the specific term is not defined either in Chapter 297A or in Minnesota Rules Chapter 8130, then the definition must be consistent with the position of the Department of Revenue as to the extent of the tax base.
Who wrote that?
I believe the language came from the department, Mr. Chair.
What tax bill is that in?
This was enacted in 2010.
2010?
Yes.
That was a good year.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, I'm being corrected by Mr. Michael. That was the recodification. So I don't know when it was actually enacted.
Chair Lincheski?
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually think the language part of that was just being read was preceded my being here. So the recodifications change things, but that's, you know, I mean, you've been a part of the Streamlined Sales Tax Initiative, you personally, Mr. Chair, and, you know, that's all about using the same base. And that's what we've been doing. In fact, we've had these issues, as you know, and you'll have them too coming up here. If you go move the auto parts taxes over to the Transportation Committee, at least money, you have to line it up with legacy. You have to line it up with all the state sales tax things. You have to, you know, these things don't happen in a vacuum, and the local taxes have to follow the state base. Or we would have, you know, some states have that. I mean, they have completely different sales tax bases. Depending on, you know, where things, you know, by county and by city and things like that. You know, we require that that's not the case. So I heard you will continue this discussion, but I think people should know that but for a change in the law, if you do nothing, Mr. Chair, this year, you don't do the departments, you don't pass legislation, we're going to go forward knowing that folks have to pay the tax. So, you know, I do think it's important to find out if the OTCs are remitting the tax that they're required to in current law.
Thank you, Chair Lincheski. Mr. Carlson, then I think we're going to go on, members. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Joel Carlson, and I've long represented the online travel companies and travel tech, and in 2011 I retained Mr. Ines to help me with this account, and I can tell you that the first bill that was introduced with this effective date language to clarify the law was introduced in 2009 by Representative Lesh, 2 years before the tax was even imposed. So we don't think that this is a clarification of the law, because it tried to clarify something that wasn't even in place when it was first introduced. But I want to make one thing clear, Mr. Chair and members, that Representative Lincheski said. The idea or suggestion that there is some tax avoidance here, I think, is unfair. The OTCs hotelier remits all local lodging taxes that are due on the total amount that the consumer pays for the room. And in 2011, in the special session, and I remember it well because it was not in either tax bill, and Representative Ines or former Commissioner Ines and I suffered collective chest failure when we found this provision in the
Mr.
tax
bill. Mr. Carlson, that session was not that special.
When we found this in the tax bill and had to tell our clients that a new tax was going to be imposed upon them on their service fee. And that's how we interpret the law. And it took us almost 12 months to negotiate the revenue notice with the Department of Revenue to how this would actually be implemented. But we remit a sales tax on our service fee, and that's what we believe you amended in 2011 in 297A, and it does not apply to local lodging taxes. And that was our position throughout our discussions with the department. They brought up this issue on 270C, which we do have some issue with. I think an easier way to fix this is to clarify that it does not apply to local lodging taxes and eliminate the alleged unfairness that happens with Minneapolis, St. Paul, Bilobic, and I forget the fourth one. There are four that are collected by the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make clear that there is no avoidance of the tax by the OTC or by the hotelier.
Thank you very much. With that, and again, members, this will be in our possession. I'll move House File 1590 as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Okay, so with that, thank you, Mr. Cummings. Oh, did you want to respond to any of this here?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say thank you to the committee. Thank you to you, Mr. Chair, for hearing these bills. We think that this is a good tune-up to the tax code, and we look forward to ensuring that you get the whole tune-up. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, item next will be going to House File. I'll move House File 1176, a Hoppy Bill, lawful gambling taxes modified. Then we'll go to Atkins. There's some similarities in the two bills, but I think we'll do them separately. Or, Chair Hoppy, what do you prefer? Separately?
Mr. Chair, it's your preference. Maybe what we could do is hear the first bill and then leave Mr. Lund, Mr. Bowen up here and bring Chair Atkins up, or maybe...
That's what we'll do. So okay. I'll move House File 1176. First of all, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of 1176?
And Mr. Chair, we do have that amendment that we talked about previously. The page is going to distribute
it. Okay, let's pass out the amendment and let's let the members look at that for a bit.
Mr. Chair, would you like Mr. Lund to explain the what the amendment does while it's being passed out?
Yeah, let's do that. But first of all, is there anyone in the audience which testify in opposition, with concerns on this bill? Okay, does the department wish to testify on this bill?
We're going to review the amendment.
Okay. So I'll come back to the department. Okay, let's just talk about the bill as amended, even though we haven't amended it yet. I'm going to give the members some time to take a look at it here. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alan Lund with Allied Charities of Minnesota, Executive Director.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
So the bill as amended reduces the tax rates for charities several ways. One is the first $50,000 will now be tax exempt, and that mirrors what is done for exempt charities today. Linked bingo moves from the combined receipts tax to the 8.5% bingo tax. The clarification on the audit, where for gambling charities, the $750,000 meeting the OAG requirement is our sales minus prizes. So any charity that would be banking $750,000 in a year would be subject to an audit. And then also the triggers for the combined receipts move to $100,000, $200,000, and $300,000.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? The department, any comments, or do you need a little more time? Or? Okay, we can come back to it if you have some comments you'd like to make, Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair,
Chair Hoppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I believe that the potential revenue conflict was taken care of in the amendment, and if it wasn't, I'll work with Mr. Cummings and the department to make sure we get it, or actually Mr. Lund will probably work with them to get it figured out before you come out with the omnibus bill.
Okay, thank you, Chair Hoppy. We do have the amendment. First of all, I've moved the 1176. I will now move the H file or House file 1176-A2 amendment. Questions? This is again the shape the author would like. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if we could have a little bit more explanation on the change in the auditing. I know of several charitable organizations that in the past in my area have run into problems. They weren't necessarily big organizations, and I think the gamblers and the taxpayers kind of like audits of this kind of operation. So could you explain what the amendment does and how that changes the current?
Mr. Lund.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. So it's correct that what we're seeking is to be treated like all other nonprofits, that if you meet the standard of $750,000 in what I call bankable money, money that you actually put in the bank, you would be required to have the audit. It does not remove the Department of Revenue's ability to call an audit at any time they wish. The Gambling Control Board, which does our compliance reviews every 18 to 24 months, a monthly reporting system that is that has no equal in the United States. We have a very rigorous monthly reporting. So basically, any time, or the IRS certainly can call one at their discretion, any time any of those agencies smell smoke, they have the ability to come in and do a complete, thorough examination. All we're saying is that the we would really appreciate being treated like all other nonprofits. While people say we are a cash business, the one caveat is the one of the biggest fraud happenings in charitable gambling in my recollection was after all the money hit the bank. Had nothing to do with cash. So our the crux of our argument is just to be we would like to be treated like all other nonprofits.
Well, Mr. Chair, I actually have a problem with that because that you're operating as a business, a gambling business. You're not operating like other nonprofits, which are based on goodwill and people just giving money out of their paycheck because of the good benefits that are done. They might have a bake sale. They might have a few other small fundraisers. But they're not in a business in which actual fairness is a really key value, and the reputation of the charity is really at risk and really solidified by having an audit so that the good people who run the charity can say to the people who are at their buying their pull tabs or whatever it is, this is, you know, our people are doing a good job and it's all okay. Because some charities have actually gotten their good name tarnished when they've had employees that just are just a little too tempted. And they, I think, really appreciate the fact that this is a regulated business, and I don't think it's an undue burden given the amount of money and the amount of trust that's put into these operations.
Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler. So the issue, again, for us is that we are, we believe, a pretty highly regulated business. When you talk to the Minnesota Department of Revenue, what I've been told personally, face-to-face, is they don't even read the reports. They go into a box. They go into a closet. They're never even read. This organization that I was talking to you about, that there was major fraud, they had several audits that did not catch anything, and it was the Gambling Control Board in their review that caught the issue. We're spending upwards of $5 million a year on these audits, and all we're saying is that we would like to see that that expense, and we're not saying you need to catch $5 million in bad goings on. We're just saying there should be some return on that expenditure. That and we don't see that. And when I asked the Department of Revenue, when's the last time that one of these audits actually led you into a case that, that proved wrongdoing, I'm told they can't remember one.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, Mr. Chair, if the Department of Revenue isn't looking at them, then I don't think they're going to find things that will lead them into discovering anything. I would hope that it is the board of directors of the charity who actually are reviewing these and see this as a normal course of business. And can you tell me the total amount of charitable gambling that would be subject to this, the total dollar amount?
Mr. Lund?
I don't have the exact amount, but our top 30% of our charities do roughly 80% of our dollar volume. It would be the charities that would still be applicable to that audit would be less than 100 of our 1,200.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just trying to put the $5 million in perspective, and if it's $5 million out of a $200 million wagering, or you know how that relates, because I do know of organizations that have run into problems, and I think, you know, I'm not sure if the audit would have caught all of them, but I know of, it has been a challenge, and an audit is a good safeguard to the people who are wagering as well as the people who step up to the board of directors.
Chair Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler and members. We agree, and we want audits, and we want people. It's bad for all of us. It's bad for the people that gamble. It's bad for the charities. It's bad for everybody if there's anything going on. We still have Mr. Barrett and the Gambling Control Board that is looking at all of these things and making sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. I mean, we can't legislate against somebody who wants to do something, you know, wrong, illegal, but the ability to catch them, I don't think, will be diminished by this. I mean, we're all in favor. It helps in the long run if we're gambling control or IRS or revenue or anybody, the board of directors of the charities. If you're talking about Ducks Unlimited or, you know, Pheasants Forever Banquet or whatever it would be, it does not help them at all to have any even implication or hint that they're doing something wrong, because then people aren't going to come there and, as you said, support the charity the next year. So I have confidence in Mr. Lund and Mr. Barrett and the people running the charities that they're going to stay on top of this. It's in everybody's best interest to do so.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you.
The gentleman from Lyon, is your question to the amendment or to the bill?
It is to the amendment.
The gentleman from Lyon.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be specific to Mr. Lund or maybe fiscal staff potentially, but on line 1.21 and then 1.22, I was carrying a bill last week that looked at, obviously, if you look at the percentages, you've got anything over 300,000, 34% for taxation purposes. There's also, I believe, 100 and some cities that also have a 10% tax on charitable organizations, and wanted to see, would that $50,000 first exemption also take care of that 10% portion that cities tax as well, or is that kind of a different, or is that not viewed as a tax?
Mr. Lund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Swedzinski, that is not technically a tax, and this $50,000 would apply to all charities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you.
Representative Ansells.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what's really at stake here is charitable good works in every one of our communities. And having had something to do with developing those compliance reviews years ago, I can tell you that this is probably the state's most overly regulated and some would argue overtaxed enterprise that we have created. And nonprofits who have as their mission doing good works for others in their communities apply for a license and get into the business, you know, on their own volition. They know clearly what's at stake, what the regulatory environment is, and this provision gives just a little bit of regulatory relief. And I would argue that the compliance reviews, if Mr. Barrett is given the time and the staff and the capability to review all those compliance reviews, is more than adequate. I think this is a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Ansells. Now we are to the amendment. Any other discussion on the amendment? If not, I will move the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill as amended, the shape that the author would like. Further discussion? The department? Why don't we hear from the department, then we'll go to Representative Loeffler. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please,
Mr.
Sir.
Chair, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. First of all, on the amendment, I am on line 1.24 of the amendment. It talks about deleting subdivision 1B on page 3 of the bill. And this would have, you know, we try and make sure that all of our forms are responsive to what we need in order to audit this and to get the necessary information. So anytime that a taxpayer thinks that a tax form is not put together in a way that doesn't get the correct information, we're open to those conversations, and I know Mr. Lund has approached the department. So I think it is appropriate that that comes out, and so we thank them for that. I did want to just note that under in the amendment, and I'm seeking clarification, Mr. Chair, on line 1.26, it deletes, on 1.25, it deletes section 5, but so I'm just wondering, would there still be an annual audit requirement under 297E? I don't feel like this would be going away. Maybe I'm just reading the amendment, Mr. Chair, but I know that Section 349 references 297E, and if you don't deal with 297E, then the audit requirement is still there, I would believe.
Mr. Clayman, to the Cummings point.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The reference in the amendment to deleting Section 5 would restore the way that the current audit requirements exist in 297E06 Subdivision 4.
Okay.
Mr. Cummings?
Okay.
Questions for members? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wonder if we could have some information on why on lines 1.14 we would reduce the electronic link bingo taxation from a combined receipts tax to the 8.5% tax.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, basically today the electronic link bingo being taxed at the combined receipts rate is a barrier to charities entering into that electronic gambling. And last year, I believe that the state collected about $12,000 in tax on the link bingo. And we believe that if it's in the 8.5% bingo tax, where bingo's always been taxed, that there will be charities that want to get involved with that business. And we'll see it as a reason to grow their business, which in turn we believe would send more money into the state.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Lund, what percent of a reduction is that?
Mr. Lund,
to go to the 8.5%.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, it really depends on whether you're a charity that's paying the 9, the 18, the 27, or the 36.
Well, Mr. Chair, the fiscal note doesn't give us any breakdown of these things, but I think the net effect of this is to reduce the electronic bingo contributions to the payment of the Viking state obligations on the Viking Stadium and to effectively transfer that to the general fund, which we were assured when this was passing through was never going to be an obligation. This was going to be the gamblers of Minnesota paid for our Viking Stadium. And now we're going to take it off even more. I have been quite honestly surprised that we haven't ended up with electronic bingo halls proliferating. I think there's still a potential if somebody was creatively enough putting this together. And I'm not disappointed that hasn't happened, but I am surprised, like many I think were. But I don't understand why we would reduce and transfer to the general fund the funding of the Viking Stadium even more, even though this clearly was a proposal that never, ever even began to start to meet the state's obligations under that.
Mm. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. I agree with you, and one of the things that I think we should have done then is make it more attractive for charities to want to do this. And what happens with these charities is there's no incentive right now for them to go away from, traditional pull tabs or we're just giving them another option with the link bingo. And the idea being that if we make it a little bit more advantageous for them from a tax perspective, more of them will decide to get into the business and offer that as an option to their patrons, thus generating more money from it and hopefully making it more successful.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the credibility of this industry to make projections about what will happen has been sorely depleted, if it even exists, after the experience in which we were given tremendous assurance that the revenues would be there to avoid general fund dollars going to the Viking Stadium. And so I don't know that I think that adding more tax relief to a business that hasn't gotten off the ground is in any way something I can be confident in. And I think that it ought to remain in its current status with the higher taxes. If the industry thinks it has potential, then they need to figure out how to market it without a tax break.
Chair Hoppe.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Loeffler.
No, that's fine.
Chair Thank Hoppe. You, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. And I think it's important when we talk about businesses is to remember that this is youth hockey, and this is the Lions, and this is little kid wrestling and little league and things like that. And these are people that are taking this money. If we're giving them a tax break and hoping that that more people use this, if this works out right, more money should come into the state, but also more money should be staying in all of our communities. And, you know, people make the choice that they want to go to the Legion or wherever it is and go gamble, but that money, the profits from that are going into back into the community in all kinds of various ways.
Representative Loeffler.
That's fine.
Representative Ansels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can't resist saying that of all of the charitable purposes in our great state, the state of Minnesota is the largest charitable recipient of charitable gambling. Think of that.
Thank you. Other questions for members? Chair Knobloch and then Groffel. Chair Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Ansel's last point, I guess I always thought that the word charity had something to do with voluntary contributions. But anyway.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch. Chair Groffel. Okay. Any other questions for members? Okay, you have the last word, Chair Hoppe.
Members, thank you very much for a good discussion. We would much appreciate your support and like to be included in the omnibus bill. And I know Representative Atkins is up next with another bill dealing with the charities. And, you know, whatever the committee sees fit to do, I think both of us and Mr. Lund and Mr. Bowen, we're just trying to help out all of our charities across the state. So I appreciate your time and appreciate your support. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Chair Hoppe. And I will renew my motion on House File 1176 as amended, but that it be laid over for possible inclusion on this tax bill. Thank you, Chair Hoppe and Mr. Lund. Item
Thank you,
next,
Mr. Chair, members.
We're going to House File. I will move House File 1185. Chair Groffel.
I just want to compliment the chair. This is the only committee room that I participate in that is appropriately at the right temperature. This is perfect. So I just wanted to compliment
you. You can hang me.
Sometimes you just get lucky. Okay, with that, welcome committee. Chair Atkins, I will move House File 1185. Are there any amendments? Seeing none, please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's nice to be back in the tax committee. I think this is perhaps the simplest bill you may see this session. It cuts the taxes in half for charitable gambling, 36%. I am not aware, and I've asked a lot of folks. I haven't asked Mr. Michael yet, but I'm not aware of any higher rate for any enterprise or industry in the state of Minnesota. In fact, in my brief review of what other states do, I've never seen a rate in any other state that is this high for anything. It seems to argue, especially in a time of surplus, that maybe this would be the year to cut those rates. The proposal is to cut each of the rates in half. We have, in times of deficit, we've increased those rates to the point where Representative Ansels has said now the number one recipient of charitable gambling proceeds, state of Minnesota. Not the charities themselves, not the little, you know, as Representative Hoppe so eloquently put it, it's not the little leagues and the wrestlers and the hockey groups and the theater groups anymore. It's the state of Minnesota. So I think it's time. I would note, by the way, I'm in full support of Representative Hoppe's bill as well. He's expressed supportive words for mine. This isn't, in spite of the now scarring on my forehead, we didn't get into a fight over which bill. We hope you'll support both. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I've got a pretty erudite testifier here to talk about rates as well.
Okay, thank
you. You know what that means, Al?
I do.
All right. I don't, so if you could kind of, whatever it means, do it.
Chair Atkins, I don't understand a thing you just said. Okay, is there anyone that wishes to testify on behalf of House File 1185 other than who we have at the table here? Anyone that wishes to testify with concerns on the bill? Does the department wish to testify? Does not? Okay. Mr. Lund, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The charities are in support of House File 1185. Again,
the basis of this request here and the help that we've been given by both Representative Atkins and Representative Hoppe is again to showcase the stack I have here is 37,000 donations that were made in our communities in the year of 2013. And I had tried to share with each of you what happens in your individual districts and the $42 million that went into our communities and the good works that those things do. And the key piece here is when people are charities, we do not get to deduct any expenses. So the charity that's paying a 36% rate, that's on every dollar you take to the bank. 50% of our money goes to expenses, games, insurance, wages. So really when you look at it, a person, the charity that's paying a 36% is actually paying 70-some percent of the money that they have left over after they pay their expenses. It is a very large amount. And we do not build up reserves. We do not feather our own nests. This is money that would get spent in the community. The only people that carry over money are people that are adding new sheets of ice, are buying fire trucks. Other than that, if you're carrying over money, you're paying Minnesota UBIT and federal UBIT. There is no incentive to carry over money. Our job is to get money into our community. We do not feather our own nests. We help other people build their nests.
Questions for members? I think the bill's pretty straightforward. Mr. Lund, I do have one question. These are two very important bills, House File 1176 and House File 1185. Which one do you like better?
Mr. Chair, excellent question, and I love both these children. So really the issue is the Hoppe bill is a 32% decrease overall. The Atkins bill is a 50%. And we would leave it at the Solomon-like wisdom of the committee to decide which of those or a combination of the two. we will be forever in the committee and chair's debt if either one of these were passed.
Mr. Lund, you're good. You are really good. Okay, without any questions for members? If not, I will move that House File 1185 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Chair Atkins, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Representative Hoppe. item next, I will move House File 1083. Members, if you could take out House File 1083, a Considine bill. I see no amendments. Is there a revenue note somewhere? Okay, the revenue note members should be coming out. But as that's happening, first of all, welcome to the committee, Representative Considine.
Thank you.
I'll ask the questions on House File 1083. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of 1083? Is there anyone who wishes to testify with concerns on 1083? Does the department, Mr. Cummings, does the department wish to testify on House File 1083? Okay. That was a no. Okay, we should have the numbers here, the revenue note. Thank you for that. Welcome, committee, sir, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 1083 was brought to actually Senator Sharon. She asked me to co-author it here. It is a business owner in Mankato that approached her. Basically, if you are in the hospitality industry, there is a tax credit from the federal government to help cover the cost of Social Security on tipped wages, and the idea of this bill is to relieve some of the other industries that rely on tips, cab companies, hair salons. My understanding is the gentleman that came to Senator Sharon, Jeff Royce, owns a hair salon. And they're looking for some relief as well. And actually, if we have a fiscal person here, I think they could probably explain it better than myself as far as how it exactly would work.
Okay, maybe we'll do that. Mr. Michael, do you want to get in a little more detail here as to what we're doing or trying to do here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, essentially what this bill does is to replicate the federal TIP credit, as Representative Considine said. That credit only applies to businesses that are in the food and beverage industry and wage under the federal law. They get a dollar-for-dollar credit for the FICA tax that the employer pays. That federal credit only applies, as I said, to businesses that are in the food and beverage industry. So what House File 1083 does is it says that we will allow a state tax credit that's the same as the federal credit for businesses that are not in the food and beverage industry, except that the federal deemed minimum wage is not the baseline, but rather the Minnesota minimum wage. So that essentially what that will do is for tipped employees, and it could be somebody like a hotel bellboy or whatever they call them.
Bell person.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm living back in the whatever. Just
phone call. Sorry, Mr. Michael, didn't mean to jump all over you. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Thinking back to movies. Or hair salon people and so forth, that they would get a dollar-for-dollar credit on the employer share of the FICA tax that is imposed on those reported tips above the state minimum wage.
Mr. Michael, is this two-tiered, or is it?
No, one-tier.
One-tier. Representative Dabney, to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just the clarification I need from Mr. Michael. If I understand the process, I report to you the tips I receive. You pay the FICA on that and Social Security on that. And then you deduct the employee portion of that from my presumably next paycheck. So you are only paying the employer part of the FICA and Social Security. And this credit only applies to that, or does it apply to the full initial payment?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, it only applies to the employer share, so they do not get it on the amount that they're withholding from the wage payments.
Okay. Chair Dabney.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Michael.
Questions from members? Testimony from the audience. Chair Carlson.
Well, just very quickly, just want to comment. I had to slip out here a few moments ago. I've got a bill dealing with mobile hair salons. And one of the TV stations became interested in that. You know, every once in a while you introduce a bill on behalf of a constituent, and all of a sudden that's the second TV interview on the issue. And I walk back in here and we're talking about hair salons, different issue, but apparently there's a lot of interest in the industry of late.
Any other questions for members? Okay, with that, thank you, Representative Considine. I will move that House File 1083 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, sir.
Could I just say thank you to House staff for explaining it much better than I could have?
Well, you did very well. Did very well. Okay, item next, we will go to the Petersburg bill. Representative Petersburg will move House File 1423. And there are no amendments that I see. And we have the revenue note for members. And before Representative Petersburg gets started, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify with concerns thereof? Does the department wish to testify on the bill? Okay. And that's a no from the department. Please present your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I know we have a lot of testifiers in the next bill, so I'll keep this very brief. It's a fairly simple bill, but I appreciate the committee giving me the opportunity to present this for your consideration. And as we know, transportation has had a lot of discussion right now, but when we talk about the gasoline tax, most of us consider that as a road user fee. And this bill simply says that there are oftentimes some purchases of fuel that doesn't get used for vehicles or for parts of the transportation issue that actually is on the roads. And so basically this puts together a request that things like when you buy gasoline to run the compressors that are on refrigeration trucks, for example, that you aren't paying that user fee. Things like if you have a non-licensed vehicle, such as driving and moving semis around in a warehouse lot or in a warehouse, that you don't need to pay that tax. Or if you're driving something that uses a power takeoff. And for those of you that may not be aware of that, things like cement trucks. When they're standing still at a site, at a job site, and they're there for a half hour or an hour before they finally get unloaded, they really don't want the cement to set up, so it has to continually move and turn. Farm trucks that are delivering feed, for example, as they unload those trucks in, are not using that fuel for on-road usage. And so basically this just gives the same exemption as other off-road uses are, in which they can go ahead and claim a refund on those dollars that they would have paid for this. My understanding is that this had been in place for many years, and a few years ago it was taken back off during some of our budgetary constraints, and this just again is putting it back on the statutes, allowing them for getting this refund for gasoline purchases that are not used for direct road usage. And that's, in essence, basically what it is.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Any questions from members? Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be a question for staff. So what about Representative Petersburg, your discussion about the power takeoff unit on auxiliary engines, et cetera, kind of raised a question. What do we do now about taxing the fuels that are used in generators and other items that may not be on wheels, that may be at work sites, even gasoline that's used in somebody's ice auger or something? How does that fit into this or not?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Drazkowski, those uses do qualify because they're not used for highway purposes. There's a refund amount. There are certain restrictions on that, but essentially what happens is they end up paying the sales tax instead, because when you pay the highway fuels tax, that automatically provides you a sales tax exemption. Whereas if you don't pay the highway tax, then the sales tax applies. If you'll notice with Representative Petersburg's bill, what it does is it provides actually both the excise tax exemption and the sales tax exemption. So if you look on the revenue estimate, the cost really is the cost to the general fund of the sales tax exemption. And so those users are, you know, typically ending up paying the sales tax as it is. Now there's a little distinction here in that the bill allows exemption where right now if you have to have a separate gas tank to qualify for the refund on the power takeoff unit. And if you look at the bill, it eliminates that requirement that you have a different fuel tank. So that's like a little quirk of this. But in general, those off-highway users pay the sales tax, not the excise tax.
Thank you,
Chair Drazkowski. Chair Torkelson, then Chair Earhart. Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Representative Petersburg, as far as the power takeoff units where there is no separate tank, how do we determine the amount of fuel used in those units?
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Turtleson. I believe there is a formula that had been calculated in prior legislation for that piece, but that would be an issue that would have to be resolved at this point, but it would be a calculation of a formula.
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Petersburg. I seem to understand from Mr. Michaels that it was that this provision was new. Is that correct, or that it had not been in law before?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, I don't remember about. What I was referring to is the provision in existing law that requires the separate supply tank. I think that is probably accurate that there was, the recesses of my memory tell me that there was a provision like this and that there is a formula, but I don't want to attest to that.
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm
done. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering if I could slip in an amendment here. I've got two off-road vehicles that I buy gasoline for, and I've never been reimbursed for them. One's a snowblower, and the other one's a lawnmower, so I think that they're in a metro area, there might be more cause for that than, than what we're talking about here. You think that's a good amendment for your bill?
For some Petersburg? Is that friendly?
And no comment at this point. I think we're really dealing with those that are paying in a substantially amount of dollars that we have. And in that regard, to the personal use, then I think you'd be looking at a sales tax issue rather than a gasoline tax. And so the limited dollars that you might use might not be as much as you think in refunds.
Chair Earhart?
Mr. Chairman, they are, it's an excess tax that I pay and I put in there, and collectively, there are probably just as many, we'd have to do a survey on that, of people that have the type of off-road vehicle that I'm talking about, burning gas, as what we're looking at here. So I just thought I'd mention that. It seems to me only fair.
Thank you, Chair Earhart. The gentleman from Lyon.
My question was already asked.
Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not advocating what I'm about to ask about one way or the other, but back in my college days, I used to work at a national food warehouse, and one of my responsibilities when I was working was to unload railroad cars. Some of them were refrigerated, and they would have their units running. I don't know where railroads fit into this whole question. If I look at the summary, it says for refrigeration units on a licensed motor vehicle. I don't know how we define a boxcar that would be loaded with, by the way, we used to imported a lot of Argentine meat that was frozen, I remember that. But very seriously, where do railroads fall into that whole question, because they would have units on some of their cars that are refrigerated?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Petersburg.
My guess is that they would qualify the same as it would for the diesel fuel for their engines that run them, and farmers and farming who also buys fuel that is treated differently and handled differently than road use dollars. So my guess is that they've been exempted from those taxes for years because of that. But again, that's just my perception as to what I know of the fuel usage.
Sure, it's more a curiosity question. I just happened to, when we were talking about refrigerated units, remembering, by the way, the good job is to unload the refrigerated cars after they've been sitting out on a siding for a long time, because they were cool as opposed to the other cars that you'd just almost die of the heat if you were unloading a regular boxcar. I was just curious. Thank you.
Mr. Michael, at that point, don't they have to be licensed?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I have no idea if we, I suppose trains are either licensed separately somehow or not licensed at all. They're mainly regulated federally.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Questions for members on this bill? Okay, with that, Representative Petersburg moves that House File 1423 be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, President Petersburg. Item last, we have House File 1544, a Nash bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I could get a page to help us out.
Yeah, if you could. I don't know if we really need to hear this bill.
Mr. Chair, I asked the page to pass out treats, as I was warned sternly that treats are sort of a tollway fee to present here as a freshman. So I have accommodated that request.
And they're non-taxable, and we will hear the bill gladly.
Yeah.
Nothing but the finest.
Okay, I will move House File 1544. So, members, if you take that out, please. And, of course, treats are not a requirement by any means. They have a bill heard. Doesn't hurt. Doesn't hurt a thing, but. Okay, so with that, I'll move House File 1544. Representative Nash, if you could please describe your bill.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Members, House File 1544 is a pretty straightforward bill. It is to amend the premium cigar tax. It has two areas that you should note. It's got line 1.9 and line 1.18. That's what it does. Is it lowers the tax on premium cigars from $3.50 to $0.50, and then it redefines briefly something that that also constitutes a premium cigar. But that's what it does. I'd like to first talk about what it doesn't do, because I think that's important to the conversation that we're going to have here today. It does change those areas, as I pointed out, but what it doesn't do is it doesn't talk about small cigars, it doesn't talk about chewing tobacco, it doesn't talk about cigarettes, it doesn't talk about snus, it doesn't talk about any of these other things. And I really want to make sure that we constrain our conversation today to that which it does do. There are many cigar stores around the state of Minnesota, and I've got several in my district, and they are struggling to get by because of the taxation that has been levied on top of these premium cigars. And they have reached out to me on a good number of occasions and said this is very difficult for them. Most of them, all of them that I've been to, are family-owned cigar stores, and it's making it tough for them to get by. And I think that as a reasonable request to look at what this bill does is it also enables them to make a living, to purvey to people who are willing participants, adults. You know, I myself like an occasional cigar, and I'm a lot like many of you who will enjoy a cigar on my deck in the summertime or on my fishing boat, or as Chair Davids has probably seen in his many trips to the golf course, to people on the golf course. I think that most Minnesotans would agree that a bill like this that's going to make it easier for family-owned businesses to succeed and thrive by selling to a group of adults who are willing consumers. Mr. Chair, I'm going to stop here, and I have several testifiers on my behalf, and I would invite them. I've got them here, and we'll invite them to introduce themselves.
Okay, just logistically here, members, we're looking at a Mark Wolf and a Joel Rogers, and then Mr. Port Holton. Then I have on the list Jill, Jack McNaney, and Dr. Russell Lupker. Is there anyone else in the audience? Oh, backside. Oh, wow. Latricia, Hannah Simmons, Molly, and Dr. Lisa Mattson. Is there anyone else who wish to testify on behalf of or with concerns on the bill? Does the department wish to testify?
No, thank you.
We got a smart department, I'm telling you. Okay. With that being said, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Wolk, and I own and operate Stogies on Grand, a premium tobacconist shop. Good day. Thank you. I represent the third generation in our family involved in the premium tobacco business in Minnesota. Stogies has been at the same location for 18 years. We are a small business with real ties to our community, and we are part of the fabric that is historic Grand Avenue in St. Paul. I'm here today to ask you to change our tax cap to 50 cents per cigar to align with our neighboring states. There are just a handful of premium tobacconists in Minnesota, and most of us employ 10 to 12 people. We are retailers with the Minnesota tax distinction of being distributors since we purchase our products out of state. We are currently being burdened with the highest tax rate in the country at a rate of 95% or a $3.50 cap per cigar. Our neighboring states, such as Wisconsin and Iowa, are currently at a 50-cent cap. We have to compete with our neighbors and the Internet, who sell a box of 20 cigars for $60 to $90 less than we can. That leaves both our stores and the state of Minnesota at a huge disadvantage, and ultimately the losers in the revenue.
People come to our store to try one or two cigars and then shop out of state for more favorable prices on box purchases. Each year, our buying power diminishes because, unlike other industries, we have to pay the monthly tobacco tax before we sell our product. Starting in January of 2015, a loophole in the statute was found, and we were required to begin paying a 95% tax on our freight charges. Yes, you heard that right. That is 95% on freight. This added another 50 cents to every cigar in the box of 20. Premium tobacconists are purveyors of fine products just like wine and coffee, and our customers are very similar. We are a gathering spot for people of all walks of life from every social and economic background. People enjoy a fine cigar to celebrate happy and momentous times in their lives. Our store has never had an underage violation. We do not promote to young people, nor do we encourage that business. Our business should never be lumped with hookah, glass pipes, or discount cigarette sellers. I very much appreciate you allowing me to speak to you today. Both the retail tobacconists and the state of Minnesota could be the beneficiaries of a change to the tobacco tax and cap. Thank you.
Okay, I think we'll go to the next testifier, then we'll have you two stay here. We'll have member questions, and then we'll go on to the next folks. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Okay, Representative, thank you. Joel Rogers. Own and operate a retail store in Maple Grove, Minnesota called Tobacco Grove.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Not much to add. Mark's story is very similar to mine. Small business owner. I have one partner, and we have two full-time employees and four part-time employees. We've been in this business since 1992. We're friends from high school, but so we don't have the family ties that Mark has, but we hear on a daily basis consumers coming in and saying that we're going to go somewhere else to buy these. They'll come in and try one out, take it home, but they're going to make their purchases somewhere else, whether that be Wisconsin, Iowa, Michigan, the internet. And that's lost revenue for us, and it's lost revenue for the state of Minnesota. So that puts us, it's a tough environment to do business in when our pricing is our cost is nearly what the retail price of that item is in other locations. That's essentially it. I think Mark did a good job kind of summing up what we do as a business. A very charitable group of retailers. We contribute to all of our local charities that come and ask, and certainly statewide ones as well. So I'd like to make sure that the neighborhood is supported, and they support us, and we support them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Now that we've somewhat normalized relations with Cuba, can you get Cuban cigars now? Legally,
the change, as my understanding is you can go to Cuba easier, and when you're there, you can return with up to $100 of Cuban cigars or Cuban liquor. That's
so
it.
So you bring two home.
Something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Wolk and Mr. Rogers. Mr. Wolk, can you review with us again the difference that you outlined? I didn't write it down. Between Wisconsin and Minnesota, the amount of the tobacco tax on cigars?
Yes, Mr. Wolk?
It basically comes down to they have the most that they can pay per cigar is 50 cents, and we have to pay up to $3.50, so essentially $3 more a cigar, plus the additional shipping charge. So you're basically talking $3.50 a cigar.
So, Chair Drazkowski. So, Mr. Chair, that's seven times the tax in Minnesota as Wisconsin.
Yeah, my store is 20 minutes from Wisconsin. So,
wow.
Yes.
Chair Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, I'm just curious. You know, we have cigarettes are $2.83 a pack now in Minnesota, and we know that North Dakota is at 44 cents. Oh, yeah, I'm talking about tax. We're in Texas, Representative Erickson. Yeah.
Chair Drazkowski, I think it's up to 290, isn't it now?
Yeah.
290.
I'm sorry to underestimate that number, Mr. Chair. Almost $3 a pack for a tax.
You misunderestimated.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Corrected by you and others. Thank you. So almost $3 a pack in taxes in Minnesota, and 44 cents in North Dakota. Of course, we've heard that the governor's solution to this exorbitant tax is to have smoking cops throughout the state. I'm curious, Mr. Wolk, out of your potential customers, have you noticed the smoking cops trailing them between Wisconsin and your neighborhood?
Mr. Wolk?
Lately, I have not.
Tobacco cops?
I have not seen them lately.
Chair Draskowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Wolk. Excellent bill.
Okay, Chair Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and either for Representative Nash or the others. I understand kind of where you're going on the taxing, but could you flesh out for me why the change in the definition, taking out hand-rolled from the definition of cigar?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, members, thank you. The definition of a premium cigar previously had only included cigars that are hand-rolled, and the technology now exists so that the same constructive definition of having an all-wrapper exterior still remains, but it can actually now be made by machine. So that's why we clarified that, so that we don't get into the weeds on a poor definition.
Representative Loan?
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash. So would this open up new varieties of cigars to fall under this definition, or not necessarily?
Representative Nash?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, members, a premium cigar is a premium cigar, and it is not trying to redefine that which it is. It's trying to include, with the definition language that it already has in there, of being tobacco included inside of a leaf with adhesives that go into that. It's not changing that. It's just... I'll go over this way so I can make eye contact with you. It's just saying that a machine process now exists to still maintain the definition of a premium cigar, but it now goes beyond merely hand-rolled. The majority of cigars are still being hand-rolled, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And final question, just for the two testifiers. Of the products that you serve in your stores, would you say that most of them are still hand-rolled, or how is that changing in what you offer?
Mr. Wolk or Mr. Rogers? Mr. Rogers?
Thank you. I would say about 97% of our products, probably higher, certainly in the humidor, are representative of a premium cigar hand-rolled. So that's pretty accurate, yes.
Chair Lewin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I've got a list building here, which is fine, but I do want to make a housekeeping announcement. Members, if you could please take in your save file, if there's some stuff you could sort out of there, take it back to your office, that'd be very helpful. The save files are getting a little big here, and so if you could either just take that some of that stuff to your office with you, just leave what you absolutely have to have in the save file, if you would, please. Okay, Representative Simonson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think out of respect to Representative Nash, I will focus in on premium cigars and not focus in on any other tobacco products today. But I just have one question for either testifier, and then I'll follow it up with a comment, perhaps. But if either one of you are willing to answer the question or can shed some light on this, the tobacco contained in one of these premium cigars, and this is just simple true or false question, is that tobacco known carcinogen?
Mr. Wolk? I don't
think cigar. Thank you, and I will say that it there are no chemicals involved, unlike cigarettes. It's 100% organic, but I do not have the answer for that.
Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I didn't think we'd get a definitive answer there. But so let me make a couple of points, and then I won't speak any more on this particular topic today. But I'm pretty proud of what we did in the last session regarding tobacco products, and including premium cigars. And the reason is has nothing to do with generation of revenue to me, but it has everything to do with a change in behavior with respect to tobacco use across Minnesota. And that includes both younger kids, and it includes adults as well. And we now have data, as we've heard testimony in previous committees here this year in this committee, that what we did in terms of increasing the tax on tobacco products, including premium cigars, did change behavior to the positive. In fact, we're seeing fewer and fewer kids able to afford smoking, which is good because they're not starting to smoke and they're not carrying that habit into adulthood. And quite frankly, we're seeing more and more adults that are reaching out for help and quitting smoking. And the data is showing us that the changes that we made in the last session are working in terms of reducing tobacco use. And I think that's a very positive thing for Minnesota. Point about the revenue. And you can make the argument that the tax is too high when you compare it to neighboring states. I would counter and say that's one particular tax that I'm very proud that we have as high as it is, and I don't really care about neighboring states because, quite frankly, the revenue that we collect, even with the tax increase that we put into place, doesn't begin to cover the cost to Minnesota taxpayers in terms of health care. It doesn't even begin to cover that. And I would challenge anybody that wants to debate that. You know, this bill, I understand where you're coming from, and I know that, you know, we'll hear some testimony perhaps that premium cigars aren't being used by high school kids because, you know, this applies to a cigar that I think costs $2 or more. But the reality is, folks, that it's not always just about the kids. It's about Minnesota as a whole. And the changes that we've made have influence decisions across the state to the positive. Smoking rates are going down, and I would just encourage us, Mr. Chair, not to take, and I know that you've got a large target that you've got to work with, and this might seem attractive, but I would just encourage us not to take steps to roll back what I think have been some pretty positive effects on Minnesota's health.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. First of all, members, a couple housekeeping things here. What we'll do is, obviously, we're not going to get through all the testifiers today, and everyone will be heard. We have to go to the floor, so we will be done at 12. We will pick up this bill from where we left off tomorrow, first thing. Also on tomorrow's agenda, we have House File 1955, Erdahl, House File 1956, Erdahl. So just those two bills will make it worth coming tomorrow. House File 1994, Carlson, House File 1775, Davids, House File 89, Dabney, a spectacular lineup for tomorrow. Tomorrow's tax committee meeting. Okay, so that being said, let's go to Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, I appreciate the treat, certainly, especially during lunchtime, but a cigar maybe would have been a good idea, too. But I occasionally like to have one as well. See, I just looked on answer.com. It says that cigars don't contain any carcinogens or additives. Pretty organic is what answer.com said. Anyway, my question is, any statistics, does anyone know on the youth that maybe will partake in cigars? You know, cigars take a long time to smoke. You can't just go out and have one in the boys' room or outside. Traditionally, you don't inhale them. That's suggested. So not that they're safer. I don't want to, you know, pretend that I don't know that. But any facts substantiate that kids are adhering to smoking cigars, and therefore that was one of the reasons why the tax had to be increased to keep kids away from it? If there's any statistic on it? I would imagine it was low. That would be my guess. But if there's, you know any of that?
Mr. Chair, I have some anecdotal, but Mr. Holton can join us at the table. And while he's doing that, I'll share my anecdotal information. I did reach out to several members of school boards, administrators, and teachers. And your point is well made that you know, you don't find students sneaking out behind the bleachers to have a quick cigar. If you know what a cigar looks like or the morphology of a cigar, to go through a cigar is not a quick event. Like a cigarette might be, and because I'm going to stay true to what I said earlier, I'm not going to talk about cigarettes. We're talking about premium cigars. They are not necessarily being consumed with the anecdotal information that I have from school officials.
Okay. Thank you. And just so the committee knows, I did not inhale. With that being said, apparently we do have a testifier that has driven more than 50 miles, and it's the tradition of the tax committee to show deference. People have driven for some time, and others that are within 50 miles, we consider them to be roadies and groupies and can be here any time as a rule. So with that, let's go to, apparently there's somebody that's driven over 50 miles. If we could just kind of cut in, and then we'll come back to where we were. We certainly want to get your testimony. Is there anyone?
Someone from Duluth.
Oh, from Duluth. All right. Bulldogs. Okay, please join us here if you would.
Thank you.
I love Duluth, especially Lincoln Park. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Sure. Thank you, Chair David and committee members. My name is Jill Doberstein, and I'm with the American Lung Association based out of Duluth.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. So this year is the 50th anniversary of the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health, and we've come a long way since then. The smoking rate in Minnesota is the lowest it's ever been, but that doesn't mean that the tobacco problem is over. On the contrary, the fact that we've now got one of the lowest smoking rates in the country is proof that Minnesota's approach to tobacco prevention and policy works. Some may argue that we're too hard on tobacco in this state. I'm not one of them. I'm the first person to say, love the smoker, hate the smoking. Minnesota has a history of being tough on tobacco, and we're proud of that. The first smoke-free workplace law, the tobacco lawsuit and settlement, the free quit plan program, the wildly popular freedom to breathe, the tobacco tax, last year's e-cigarette policy. Together, they are all what has driven our smoking rate down and saved untold numbers of kids from smoking. We should be celebrating that, not trying to undo it. And yet, what this bill is proposing is what we've seen so many times from the tobacco industry, a chipping away at policies that protect the people but jeopardize the tobacco company profits. So who should we let set public health standards? Convicted racketeers who are lobbying for cheaper tobacco products, or public health advocates lobbying on behalf of health for all based on best practices set by the Center for Disease Control? Policies like tobacco taxes are popular statewide and are proven to work, both in decreasing healthcare costs that we all pay for and by encouraging smokers to quit. As lawmakers, you're here to represent the people in their interests, not the lobbyists of a dying tobacco industry. As a mother of two young girls, my interests are always in favor of policies that protect my family from exposure to smoking and that prevent them from being targeted by big tobacco. I ask you today to stand up for the people, for public health, and for my kids. Be proud of what Minnesota's achieved, and keep tobacco prices high in our state, all tobacco prices. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Doberstein. Who are the convicted racketeers that are pushing this bill?
The tobacco industry.
Cool. Okay, so let's go. And members, was there any questions for the testifier from Duluth? Thank you very much for coming down today. We also apparently have a student that is truant from school that would like to testify. If you could please come down, sir. I can sign a note for you if you'd like. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Committee Chair Davids, my name is Jack McNanny. I live at 1988 Baird Avenue, and I'm currently a student at Queen Durham Hall High School, as well as I'm with the organization called the Ramsey Tobacco Coalition.
Welcome, committee, sir.
Thank you. I'm not a newcomer to this work. Simply pulled off the street to say a few words. I, along with other St. Paul youth, work to ensure that highly flavored little cigars are sold at rates comparable to cigarettes. We were successful with our work in St. Paul, and other youth have worked on similar ordinances in Brooklyn Center and Bloomington. You may wonder why I care about this issue. I know that as an adolescent without a fully developed frontal cortex, we do not understand or think about the long-term negative impacts using tobacco will have on our lives. Before you know it, you might become addicted and not be able to quit. I'm here to oppose any reduction in the tobacco tax on cigars because it will make these products cheaper and more accessible to my peers. You may think that kids do not smoke cigars. Well, I'd like to ask you to think again. Young people model adult behaviors, and particularly model the behaviors of adults who appear powerful. I want to stop the tobacco industry from addicting people my age to their deadly products. I have suffered the loss of the mother of one of my childhood friends due to lung cancer. She was addicted to tobacco and smoked most of her short life. She started using tobacco when she was around my age. This was my main motivation to get behind this cause. I do not want other kids to become addicted, similar to my close friend's mother. Making these deadly and addictive products cheaper is not doing us any favors. My friends and I are doing what we can to prevent a lifetime of addiction. And with that, I ask you to do the same. Thank you for your time.
No, thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Very good testimony. Now, were you excused from class today to come here?
Yes, sir.
So my comment about being truant would then be inaccurate. So we will strike that from the record. So, okay, but if you do need a note, I can sign one for you.
All right.
Okay. Questions to the gentleman that just testified, Mr. McNaney?
Yes, sir.
McNaney. Okay, Mr. McNaney. Any questions for Mr. McNaney? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Thank you. Anyone else that has driven a distance or is skipping school? Legally. Legally. Okay, now let's go back. I believe we had Mr. Holton, Court Holton. And is the committee done with the questions for Mr. Wolk or Rogers? Okay. I think Representative McDonald had a question. Okay, mm-hmm. The question's been asked. Mr. Holton, response to the McDonald question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, there's a Department of Health survey that's done regularly by the Center for Health Studies, and it's been in front of this committee before, and back in 2013, and there's another one out. It shows a decline in usage of all types, I believe, in Minnesota, somewhat significant from 2000 to 2014. I think that the present statistics on underage use is for high school 8.3 and for middle school 3.8. Now, I could be wrong about that, and I'm sure there's other people in the audience that have those statistics. One thing I'd ask you to note on that, though, is that they don't delineate in the question. The question is, have you tried this in the last 30 days? I believe that's the survey question. They do not delineate between little cigars, cigarillos, and premium cigars, stogies. And it's my firm belief that close to 100% of that experimentation is with little cigars, because the premium cigars cost a lot more money and take a lot of time to consume. But that's the best I can answer that question.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question then maybe for Mr. Michael or someone an expert. Was the thought with the increase of that tax, the exorbitant tax on that premium cigar, that it would deter people from smoking, especially the youth?
Mr. Michael, are you aware of any testimony previously that addresses that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, I think it would be fair to characterize the 2013 tobacco tax increase along with the cigarette tax increases having a deterrent element as well as a revenue element. And so I don't remember anybody talking specifically about premium cigar deterrence, but in general it was to deter or reduce the amount of tobacco use.
Mr. Chair. Mr. McDonald?
Yeah, just a thought. You know, I believe that the agenda, the idea of the past majority who passed this tax is, one, it could create revenue, but more importantly, lower the threshold of smoking, youth smoking, and that's admirable, certainly. But the question is, as even Representative Petersburg just and I were talking, is that should that be done here in the tax committee? Should we do that with tax dollars? If it's really truly concerned about the health, then we need to consider other efforts other than just taxing it to death than to deter smokers. And then it's obvious that the premium cigars are not being smoked by young children. You have to go into a cigar shop, into a humidor, where youths are not allowed in the first place. They're usually $10, $12, $13 a piece and more. You're lucky if you get one for $6.95. So the thought that you're going to increase the tax by this exorbitant amount to deter children from smoking a young is really preposterous, in my opinion, and completely unfair. So if that's your agenda, then it's inaccurate and should be supported with this bill in reducing that tax. Certainly a whole philosophical difference with cigarettes, but the premium cigar has no base, in my opinion, I think, and I think you can see in common sense it doesn't make any sense to tax that to the point to keep kids away from smoking a premium cigar. That's my little editorial, and I'll end with that.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald. I have quite a list here. I'm going to take one more. Member, and then since this bill will be continued tomorrow, I would expect another white box.
Mr. Chair.
With that being said,
Mr. Chair.
Chair Anderson Mr. asks, Chair.
I mean, Mr. Chair, to that point, can we start with that then tomorrow? Because the question is all about the bill I authored. And I think I know why I authored it. Okay.
Chair Lencheski, so, I'm not cutting anyone off the
vote. I would like to respond to Representative Michael then, or McDonald tomorrow, because I can tell you exactly why I carried that bill and
you will be,
why I'm proud of that bill.
Did he mention your name?
Well, he wanted to know what was the purpose of the legislation. Okay, as the chief author, I'd like to tell you.
After Anderson asks, we'll go to Earhart, Dabney, Lencheski tomorrow. We're not going to cut debate off from. And I know that the folks that have concerns with this bill, we've heard from a couple, but not all that many. You will have full time to testify tomorrow also. That being said, Chair Anderson asks, and then we're going to wrap her up.
I can wait till tomorrow if that helps you out, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay, that's fine.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Holton.
I have to, before you adjourn, I have misinformed the committee, and I would like to correct that.
Certainly.
The present stat is, I believe, 13 for high school, not the 8.3 that I stated.
Okay, the record will note that correction. So I have my list here. We're going to pick up from here first tomorrow. Don't stop believing, members. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.